This is an ABC podcast.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hello and welcome to The Country Hour. I'm Isabella Pittaway. Great to have your company this Monday. Coming up this half hour, demand and prices for Riverland grapes are increasing because of a lighter grape crop in South Australia's premium wine producing regions. Also this lunchtime, you'll find out how the coronavirus is affecting the lobster industry during one of its busiest times of year, Chinese New Year.
We're a bit fortunate. We've sent most of our stock. We don't have a lot of stock. We were sort of aiming to buy as we go just to see how things go anyway. You never 100% sure how the celebrations are going to go anyway over Chinese New Year. It seems to change every year, so you've got to take a bit of a cautious approach, but not expected this, though.
That story is after the weather, and I'll also take you to Port Lincoln's Tunarama Festival today. And we've also had a call to say that there's a big bank up of traffic heading into Port Wakefield from the York Peninsula on the Port Wakefield Road and the big intersection where the northern traffic joins. So something to keep in mind if you are travelling on the roads today. And the winners of the Australia Day Awards were announced yesterday, and South Australia's Citizen of the Year is someone who spent much of their career in agriculture, most recently at the South Australian Grain Industry Trust Fund. But it's his volunteer work in the Clare Valley that saw Dr. Alan Mayfield recognised. Welcome to the Country Hour, Alan.
Thanks, Isabella.
First of all, congratulations on the award. What was your response? Did you know it was coming?
I did not. Not the state award. Well, I didn't know the local one was coming either, but it was a great surprise. And look, it's been a real thrill for all the people I've been involved with and the wider community here.
Now, you have worked in agriculture, and I'll touch on that in a moment, but you were awarded Citizen of the Year, really looking at the volunteer work that you do in the community with the Lions Club, but also Premier Stephen Marshall tweeted that you were a driving force in the completion of the Riesling Trail. Can you tell us a little bit about your work involved with that?
With the Riesling Trail, it's something I got on probably 7 years ago, and a lot of it is to do with maintenance of the trail. It's used a lot by locals and visitors to the Clare Valley, and in fact I'm amazed how many people do use it. But so our job is to keep the trail in really good condition, but there was some unfinished work. In fact, there always seems to be with some projects, but in this case it was the final kilometre into Auburn, which was no small project. It was crossing a highway, it was building a 60-metre bridge, and so on. And we chugged away at that. It took nearly 5 years, a lot of assistance, about $350,000. But we had good support from federal, state government and local communities, and a lot of volunteers came in and helped as well, and good local contractors. So we got there in late last year. That's done now. Yep.
And, Alan, before moving to the Clare Valley, you grew up in Kimber, is that right?
I did indeed. Yeah, grew up there and went to school there and then to school in Adelaide and beyond. But, I mean, the thing that was... Kimber was like any other country town where most of the people volunteered. In fact, they were involved with quite a few organisations. I think when my mother was in her 90s, she was involved with four different organisations, and you talk to other people and it's much the same. So it's quite a common thing in rural areas. It's not quite so obvious in the cities, but it was just a normal thing then for me to get involved with volunteering community work once I had a bit more spare time.
And also involved with the Lions Club, I believe you're volunteering today on this public holiday as well with them.
Ah, well, there's no stopping. We normal thing with Lions that you do is fundraising and barbecues and helping community, and we had a big wetlands project a few years ago where we did a lot of revegetation and maintenance of weeds in there. But anyway, about 18 months ago, we thought we'd better do something about secondhand furniture. There was a part of the op shop here in Clare, and that part of it stopped about 2 years ago. So couple of us thought, well, we'll just crank this up. It was a big thing, but we did it bit by bit, I guess. But then eventually we had to bite the bullet, and we July last year we opened up, not really knowing how it was going to go. So we've got a premises in Clare, and it's all donated furniture. So to cut a long story short, we've done really well. Over 6 months, we've been received, and I would say donated, over 1,000 items of furniture from you wouldn't believe, like the normal things, lounge chairs, wardrobes, side tables, and old quirky stuff and whatever. But it's just a big turnover. And we open Fridays and Saturday mornings, and it's all sort of volunteers, and then the money goes back into the community. So it's just a big wheel rolling around.
Fantastic. I was speaking to Alan Mayfield, who is the South Australian Citizen of the Year. And Alan, outside your volunteer work, you're also a scientific officer with the South Australian Grain Industry Trust Fund. What sort of work do you do with them?
So this is something I can still do because of my background in agriculture, so I'm pretty familiar with how things work out on farms and also how science work, because I had quite a career in science at the Wade Institute for early years. And so my job is to be a scientific advisor for the trustees, the five growers in South Australia who are the trustees of the SAGET, and Malcolm Buckby, the executive officer. So if there's when project submissions come in, which are due actually this coming Friday, I'll review them and check on them and advise trustees on their merit. But then once projects are approved, we do a follow-up and we try and get around all projects during the year and just see how they're travelling and then report back to trustees. And where we can, we try and tinker with the projects so that they get a better outcome. So that's what I do there.
And what are some of the projects that have been approved in the past?
Well, we have a full range from things that are sort of very early stage genetics right through to sort of publications and field days. But some of these, we're trying to get better productivity on sandy soils, for example, over north of Butte. We're looking at ripping and subsoil amelioration treatments. There's a project with lentils, trying to get improved lentil production in the Mallee by having an earlier, more vigorous growth type. And improve seeding establishment of these and picking earlier sown varieties. There's a nice project going on there, upper north. First was wheat and now it's gone to barley after 3 years. So looking at varietal types that suit the earlier sowing.
Alan, congratulations again and thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, Isabella.
South Australian Citizen of the Year, Dr. Alan Mayfield. And among the hundreds of Australians recognised with Order of Australia awards was Diana Lobe. Ms. Lobe received her OAM yesterday for service to conservation and the environment as part of the Eyre Peninsula Natural Resources Management Board. She explains what the recognition means to her.
It's still very much, I guess, almost shock, but I know in time that I'll really be proud of it and be very, very grateful to whoever nominated me. Yeah, so it's just very much a surprise, and I think it'll be something that I'll value for the rest of my life.
The award is for service to conservation and the environment. Mm. Tell me about the work you've done in those areas.
Primarily, it would be the work that I've done with the Eyre Peninsula Natural Resources Management Board, and 3 of those years I was presiding member. So it's been very much about setting the strategic agenda for the region, the whole region, and that's been very much the role of the board has been very much about bringing the community along, listening to the community, valuing their input, and finding out what their values are and what they see for the region. And it's been very, very much, I guess, a case of being in sync with what the board wants to do, where the board wants to go. So it's been very much a role of dealing with the community and you know, finding out more about what they want. That community engagement has been foremost the board responsibility.
One of your key areas was water management. Mm, yeah. What are some of the achievements you're most proud of in that area?
Well, the biggie has to be the completion of the water allocation plan, which was signed off by the Minister and by Parliament. I think it was 2016, 2017. So it's 2 or 3 years ago now. But that was a 5-year process that was quite an angst-ridden community engagement process. But it's I think I was just very, very grateful that the community had their, you know, participated and participated brilliantly. We certainly had a lot of different ideas, and there are some different opinions out there. But and even some of the things that we heard at the time, while I no doubt people were a bit disappointed because they didn't turn up in the actual water allocation plan itself, simply because they were outside the scope, we've then had an opportunity with a subsequent working towards, you know, a methodology of managing water throughout the region, that I think some of those other ideas have been picked up and may in fact flow through to whatever mechanisms eventuate.
What have you seen change in the way that we manage our natural resources in the time you've been working in this sector?
Well, I guess the reduction of funding has very much seen a back-to-basis approach for this region. And that's meant that we've really had to target our focus, and it's been very much to pest plants, animals, trying to control those. It's very much been about resilient soils for resilient, you know, for a future. Working with the farming sector has been key. And I think we've got more. The water allocation plan, I think, was a far more resilient document than its predecessor, as you would expect. So I think we've seen the upping, if you like, in the standard of management, that the framework, you know, the framework that we've rolled out. And I think that's standing the region in good stead. The fact that we've gone back to basics was very consistent with the Liberal Party focus at the last election. So we virtually moved to a landscape SA approach 12 months ago, even though the landscape boards won't be in place for another 12 months or so. Our board will finish. We're due to finish by the end of January, I'm expecting. And whoever takes over, there is going to be, I think we've left it in very, very good place. And I think we've worked, I think we've certainly built some relationships with the community.
Has working with local farmers been a significant part of your work?
Yeah, look, I haven't. It's mostly the relationship is mostly with staff, and so my part of it was to attend some of the workshops, really just as the head of the board. But it's been an ideal opportunity to talk with farmers and find out the issues for them. We've got some farmers on the board, and so because the board is very much skills based, and people from the fishing industry, so that's been a really good way of networking and finding out what's going on in those areas.
That's Diana Lobe, OAM, from Port Lincoln, speaking there with Lucy Robinson. Congratulations to all recipients of Australia Day awards. Up next on the Country Hour, you'll find out why Riverland wine grape demand is up.
You're listening to the Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
We're at 17 past 12, and a lighter grape crop in South Australia's premium wine-producing regions is causing winemakers to look to the Riverland to fill their need for the fruit. Prices are lifting as demand increases, and grape prices are starting to obviously reflect that change. In a first for the region, Kingston Estate Wines has published its grape prices. The company will pay around $400 a tonne for white varieties and up to $700 a tonne for reds. Managing Director of Riverland Vintners, David Harris, is on the hunt for uncontracted grapes and says demand has officially exceeded supply, with fewer grapes and less wine available on the market.
I think in the last month, people are realising that yield's going to be down significantly. And I think that because the premium districts have had such a dry year, there's a lot of interest from premium districts to fill orders that they may have had from the Riverland that might not have been there. So demand is probably tighter than it's been, I'd say, since 2001. Everyone's been working in the Chinese market. Since they dropped their punitive taxes in 2006, the market has grown at 30% compound for 12 years. And, of course, now we're running out of wine, so pretty predictable.
Is demand from China the primary reason why you think that supply is so tight?
Yes. Australian export of wine from China in 2006 was, I think, $26 million. This last year, we exported $1.2 billion to China. We've been, as an industry, carrying big stocks of bulk wine. So for the last 3 or 4 years, really without the industry fully understanding it, we've been selling more wine than we've been producing as those stocks have run down. The problem is it's hard to get the price up because there are other countries that can produce wine cheaper than we can, and Chinese markets are fickle. They may go there to to source. They're not going to stop drinking wine. They might just go there to source the wine.
Given that there's not a huge supply of uncontracted, on-the-spot market grapes available at the moment, what does this mean for your winery?
What happens is that there's two markets. There's one where people contract over several years, and that's like the CCW accolade relationship, and Treasury have some labels, but there's a lot of fruit that is traded on the spot market, probably 30% of the fruit. The price has gone up, which means that there won't be much bulk wine spec this year on the premise that you can make more money by selling it on bulk wine. And all I'm saying is that those markets which have created this shortage need to be fed, and the best way to feed them is to sell some of that fruit that's on the spot market to some of these Chinese importers so they can process it and take it.
Wine grape prices are not normally published, but Kingston Estate Wines has done that as a first for the Riverland. What sort of impact does this have on the market?
Well, I give Bill Malaradelis absolute credit for doing that. There's this Mexican standoff where wineries won't declare the prices, so no one knows what's going on. So the decisions about where the fruit's going to go often happen only a week or two before harvest. That doesn't happen in any other commodity, and the bigger wine companies need to step up and be a bit more upfront about their prices earlier. So Bill's done it. I think his prices are good. I think they're fair and reflect the market. He's as close to the market as anyone. He's the largest bulk wine supplier in Australia, and he's put his mouth, money's where his mouth is. That's become the benchmark, and now everyone else can line up behind him, which I think is great. As grape prices move up, people that buy the fruit sort of step back and go, goodness, where's my business going? But, the price of almonds, the price of citrus, and the price of table grapes has gone up enormously. There's no reason why the price of grapes can't go up.
That's Managing Director of Riverland Vintners, David Harris, speaking to Grace Whiteside. And things are getting a bit tight for the olive oil industry because smaller olive yields across the state last year have meant oil production is running low. Typically a temperamental crop, olive growers have struggled to produce consistent yields with the ongoing dry conditions. Prima Brothers Olive Oil buys fruit from South Australian growers to process at their Adelaide facility. And sales and marketing manager Dominic Katsanzariti says the company has held on to enough oil to last until the end of this year's harvest.
Last year was an average year as well. And, this year was kind of meant to be like a bigger year. But I think with the drought, it takes a toll. And, just farming in general with the olives, it's a hard gig.
In what way?
Because with the olives, you tend to get this year where it goes, you get a good year and then you get a light year the next. And a lot of growers have problems like that where you're not getting a consistent, like an average every year. You're not getting that consistency. So it makes it hard for farmers to, rely on the olive oil as a job.
Given that it has been a couple of light years then, what does that mean for olive oil production, particularly for your company?
Well, it means that we're going to probably struggle to find the oil because we normally purchase oil if we run short ourselves. So if we're running short ourselves and the growers are running short as well because they don't have full crop, then it's going to affect us. We still got the demand for it, but, if you don't have enough to supply, then you either lose customers or, and it's not good for everyone.
Is there enough supply at the moment to meet that demand?
Yes and no. It depends, what market you're targeting and stuff like that. But there's still a lot of plantations going up. So over the next 4 or 5 years, we'll probably increase the production. The demand's always growing as well. So more and more Australians are starting to use extra virgin olive oil now. So the more and more people that use it, obviously we're going to need more and more.
And is most of what is produced, does that just go to the domestic market?
Oh, in our company, yeah, mostly domestic.
And is that kind of standard across other companies as well? There's not a huge...
Yeah, most of them, but there is a lot of other companies that target other markets, not in Australia.
And whereabouts do you purchase your olives from to make this oil?
So we've got our own. We've got two groves. We've got one with about 6,000 trees and then another one with about 28,000. So this year, one of our groves is pretty good, but there was we didn't have anything at that grove last year. And that one's really good. But the other one, we had an average crop there, but this year it's looking a little under average. And then a lot of speaking to a lot of our growers, some of them that had good years last year, they're on a very light year this year.
And given that we're still a couple months away from olive harvest, is there going to be enough oil in that period before the new season of olives start coming in for processing?
Yeah, we always make sure we do have enough, so we're still okay for now. And we always make sure we've got oil just up until before we start processing. And, you know, some years if we do run out, then that's how it is. But most of the time we generally have it all year round.
That's sales and marketing manager with Prima Brothers Olive Oil, Dominic Katzenzariti, speaking with Grace Whiteside. At 26 past 12, let's head off to the Weather Bureau. It's good afternoon to Vince Rollins. Hi, Vince.
Hello, Isabella.
Now, we've got to enjoy the cooler weather until it starts heating up again on Wednesday.
Yeah, it does. We've still got some very hot conditions over inland parts of the state over the next couple of days, but really that heat isn't going to drift southwards until we get to Wednesday into Thursday. So we'll see very hot conditions over a large part of the state, probably north of about Adelaide on Wednesday, but then drifting pretty much right across the state apart from some of the coastal fringes on Thursday. So reasonably short-lived, though. We'll see some very hot conditions over the eastern border area on Friday, possibly into Saturday, but generally the state will cool down as we head into Friday. And that's due to a frontal or trough feature moving across from the west during Friday. And we're also getting an infeed of tropical moisture from the northern parts of the continent, and that looks like it's going to develop into quite a bit of shower and thunderstorm activity, possibly even developing into a bit of a rain band over initially the north of the state during Thursday, but then extending right across the sort of central and western parts of the state on Friday, and then tracking eastwards on Saturday. So, potential for some pretty good rainfall during that period. But up until then, not much happening over the next couple of days as far as weather goes. We've got the possibility of some thunderstorms up in the far northeast during this afternoon and then again tomorrow afternoon. Maybe a little bit of patchy fog around the southeast and parts of Eyre Peninsula over the next couple of mornings, but really nothing of significance. But yeah, this next feature coming through during Friday, Saturday, and that infeed of moisture from the north starting on Thursday is certainly something we'll be watching with a lot of interest. We do have those northerly winds picking up on Thursday, so we will see some higher fire dangers during that period. So at this stage, we've got four districts with severe fire dangers, but obviously we'll be monitoring that over the next couple of days. And then we do have some heat wave conditions drifting into the state as well with that really hot, very hot conditions. But yeah, potential for some good falls during Friday, Saturday. At this stage, probably thinking maybe up to 30 or 40 millimetres in some parts, but the potential for quite a bit more depending on what happens with the thunderstorm. So an interesting period. So just keep an eye on the forecast for those rainfall totals over the next few days.
We sure will. Thanks, Vince.
No worries.
Vince Rollins at the Weather Bureau. Let's look at the far west of New South Wales now. And for the Upper Western District, a hot and mostly sunny day with a slight chance of a shower in the southeast in the afternoon and the chance of a thunderstorm in the morning and afternoon. It's going to be warm overnight between the low to high 20s and then getting up to around 40 degrees. And then for the Lower Western District, a hot and sunny day overnight, a bit cooler between 17 and 23 and then getting up to between 35 and 40 degrees. Very soon you'll hear from Primary Industries Minister Tim Whetstone about the results that are in for South Australia's first snapper fishing ballot. That's since the ban has come in place. And you'll also hear the impact the coronavirus is having on the lobster industry.
You're listening to The Country Hour. For more stories from across the country, go to abc.net.au/rural. On ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill, this is Isabella Pittaway.
Hello, great to be with you this afternoon. Coming up this half hour, you're going to hear how the coronavirus is affecting the lobster industry. It's experiencing one of its busiest times of year in Chinese New Year. And look, this is probably an unpopular summer opinion, but I'm not a fan of mangoes, but perhaps you'd love the juicy, pungent fruit. Well, there's some new varieties being developed that could be on your supermarket shelf soon.
The texture, it's a much smoother texture with the eating. And they're a big mango, so you really get a nice meal out of that mango.
More on that in about 15 minutes. 0467 922 891 if you'd like to send me a text, or you can call us on 1300 222 891. It's just after 12:30, and with the latest in news headlines, it's good afternoon to Matt Coleman.
Hello, Isabella. The sporting world is in shock over the confirmation that the American basketball legend Kobe Bryant died in a helicopter crash in the US state of California. The 41-year-old, his 13-year-old daughter Gianna, and seven others are on the chopper, which crashed near Los Angeles. The Lakers player was a five-time NBA champion. The state opposition says the $3 million that the government is spending on consultants as it privatises trains and trams is a waste of money. The opposition leader Peter Malinauskas says the spending was contained in mid-year budget review documents. And the state government is providing $120,000 to help transport donated fodder to bushfire-affected livestock producers on Kangaroo Island. More than 2,000 tonnes of hay has been donated. Farmers and Livestock SA is delivering the fodder to Cape Jervis from as far away as Eyre Peninsula. ABC News.
Thanks, Matt. And look, Chinese New Year, it can be the busiest time for Southern Rock lobster fishermen, but the spread of the coronavirus in China is having an impact on the industry. Ahead of the weekend, processors in the southeast had orders cancelled, and they also had to stop accepting new stock. Ferguson Australia Managing Director Andrew Ferguson says his operations were affected.
We've had some orders cancelled, I believe others have. It's a bit of a worry with it spreading, but I do hope the Chinese will do. It does appear they're certainly being more reactive than what they were with SARS. So, fingers crossed. So, it has affected us in the fact that we've had to stop buying lobster for the moment.
Was that a decision that you expected to make?
We were hoping not to, but once we started to see orders being cancelled, we started and reading the emails and WeChat messages, the Chinese appear to be taking it quite serious, and I think they've sort of been told to pull the belt in a bit with celebrations, with community events and things like that. That's sort of not a good sign.
You've stopped accepting fish, but what about other companies in the area?
I believe everyone has done the same thing. Everyone would be feeling the same as what we'd be feeling, the nervousness in China. But it's a wait-and-see approach, I think. We're just going to see how it goes the next few days, and we'll just see how it pans out.
What will happen to all the stock you've already got?
Well, we're a bit fortunate we don't have it. We've sent most of our stock. We don't have a lot of stock. We were sort of aiming to buy as we go, just to see how things go anyway. You're never 100% sure how the celebrations are going to go anyway over Chinese New Year. It seems to change every year, so you've got to take a bit of a cautious approach. But not expected this, though.
And what could be the financial impact from this virus?
Oh, it's hard to say. I mean, the one good thing about it is most of the lobster fishermen in the southeast have near caught their quotas, and it may be the fact that it's drawn out, the season's drawn out a lot longer than we thought. That might be one of the financial downfalls, but maybe the price. Look, it's a bit early to say, but I think it'll be perhaps would be extended a bit in the season. We've still got plenty of time to go, but that might have everyone sort of thinking, I think, to finishing up soon, and that might not be the case so much.
So will prices be lower?
We'd hope not, but that'll be determined. It depends on how, you know, if we're only sending small amounts into the market at a time, that'll help keep the price up, I guess.
That was Ferguson Australia's Andrew Ferguson speaking there to Bridget Herman. And we're lunching on a bit of seafood news this half hour, and the results are in for South Australia's first recreational snapper fishing ballot. Tim Whetstone is the Primary Industries Minister. Good afternoon, Minister.
Yeah, good afternoon.
How did the ballot go?
Well, look, the ballot went pretty well. It was quite successful. Over 3,600 applications came in for the recreational fishers to receive their allocation of tags. And sadly, we only had enough tags to distribute to 606 recreational fishers, and that enabled them to receive six tags each. And the breakup has been that we've seen 392 recreational fishers in regional South Australia have been successful, and 214 in metropolitan Adelaide have received those tags.
And so snapper fishing in the southeast will reopen this weekend, is that right?
That's correct. 1st of February, the restricted season will open until the 31st of October. And that's in response to the change of management with snapper, particularly the ongoing closure within both the Gulf of St Vincent and Spencer Gulf. And that's in response to the snapper stocks being absolutely decimated over the last few years. And it's got to a point now where we've had to have an ongoing closure in the Gulfs, but we're having restricted access in our southeastern waters to give both the recreational, the charter boat operators and the commercial sector, a total allowable catch has been set, and that gives all of the three sectors an opportunity to be able to catch snapper, albeit limited, so that we can actually have a sustainable snapper fishery here in South Australia.
And what are the limits, the catch limits for rec fishers as opposed to charter operators?
Well, what we've seen is that recreational fishers, all 606 of them, will receive six tags, and so they can go out and catch six snapper. Now, those tags are non-transferable. That means that they can't be sold, albeit that if you have received tags and you go out in a boat for a day, you can have friends or family that can catch a snapper under that tag. If we look at the charter boat operators, they have received 49 tags for each registered charter boat operator, and that allows them and supports them through a trying time, and that allows people to, if you weren't successful as a rec fisher to get your tags, you can go out in a charter boat and catch a snapper to the tune of 49 tags per boat. And, of course, we have the commercial sector. They have a total allowable catch that will see them restricted to their daily limit. And once they reach their allocated catch, the season will close for them.
I'm speaking to Primary Industries Minister Tim Whetstone. Minister, while I have you on the line, I just wanted to touch briefly on the impact that bushfire and drought is having on South Australia's farmers. We heard from Rural Business Support recently, who said that more than half the primary producers in this state have been affected either by bushfire or drought. Will there be extra support available for them?
Well, look, we continue to put support measures in place for the drought-affected farmers, as we have with the fire-ravaged farmers. So we'll continue to monitor and support those farmers. And I think what needs to be commended is the generosity, and the South Australian population has opened up their hearts and their wallets to the fire-affected farmers. But we can't forget those farmers that have been affected by drought. So we've put a significant package in play for drought-affected farmers. and we're also currently assessing how we can further support our fire-affected farmers, both at Cuddly Creek and Kangaroo Island, whilst not forgetting that we've had fires on the Eyre Peninsula, Spencer, York Peninsula, beg your pardon, and the Killara fires in the southeast. And really, what we're seeing is that it's coming out of from all directions. And while we're assessing the damage and putting a level of support to our farmers, we will continue to roll out support measures so that we can continue to make sure that our farmers are given the support they need so that they can survive, they can be supported and continue to farm here in South Australia.
Primary Industries Minister, thank you.
My pleasure.
That is Tim Whetstone, who is the Primary Industries Minister. Up next, we're off to Port Lincoln.
This is ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
Where it is 20 minutes to one. Great to have your company this lunchtime. And look, we're staying with seafood and we're going to head now to the home of the world famous tuna toss. Yes, I'm talking Port Lincoln's Tunarama Festival, celebrating the tuna industry. Our rural reporter, Brooke Neindorf, is there. Hi, Brooke.
Hey, Bella. How are you going?
Good, thanks. I mean, you easily have the best job of the day today. What's happening?
Yeah, I definitely do have the best job today. I'm here in Port Lincoln. I'm down at the Port Lincoln foreshore, sitting next to the tuna polar sculpture, actually. That's the fourth day of Tunarama. It's an extra day here because we've also got the cruise ship in, so the Golden Princess is in. So a couple of thousand passengers have joined in today as well. So what a day they've got for it. The sun's out, the water's sparkling, and there's plenty of local seafood to sample. So it's a fantastic day here in Port Lincoln.
And I understand that you've spoken to the Tunarama ambassador as well.
Yeah, that's right. So the Tunarama ambassador was announced on Friday night, and it was a fantastic night. The quest entrants raise money throughout the year. They choose a charity to fundraise for, and they learn about Port Lincoln's history, the ambassadors for the town throughout the year. And Friday night, Belinda Curry was crowned as the newest Tunarama ambassador for 2020, taking over from Damien Burner. And I caught up with her earlier this morning to ask her how she felt taking on this new role.
Been that busy, I haven't really actually sat down and thought about it. I had a few tears late Friday night when I went home and seen how many Facebook messages I had and just general messages from friends, but apart from that, I think I've been too busy to actually think about it.
It is a pretty full-on weekend, and then you throw the cruise ship in on top as well.
Yeah, I was up nice and early for that this morning. My poor kids didn't want to get up, and I said, that's fine, stay in bed, I'll come get you after. But no, that was good fun this morning, so I even got called the Queen, so...
That's pretty exciting. Tell us about why you wanted to get involved in the quest in the first place.
Probably about 15 months or so ago, I was in a really bad negative spot, and as a single mum, you just can't afford to be there, and I needed a real positive space to go to. And I actually waitressed for the dinner and the award ceremony last year, and I jokingly said to the girls, wouldn't it be great if I was up there next year? And just had a bit of a laugh, and they said, oh, you could? And I thought, oh, nah, that's not me. And then once I thought about and spoke to my boss at the time, Fiona Rosalia, we thought, oh, this could actually be a really good thing. So, and I think I've become a much more positive person out of it. So there's plenty of opportunities now. So just to expand on everything that we've done, and the Royal Flying Doctors have got a massive kick out of it. So,
and that is correct. You are had raised money for the Royal Flying Doctors Service. Why was that charity chosen for you?
They actually saved my life nearly 15 years ago now. I had to fly in Adelaide for life-saving surgery. There was no surgeons available at the time here, and they got me to Adelaide pretty quick. Without them, I actually wouldn't have my kids today. Even if they did manage to save my life here, I wouldn't have been able to have kids. So I am very, very lucky to have them, and I just needed to give something back, and it was a perfect opportunity for me to go, hey, this is my opportunity.
What do you love about Tunarama?
I love being able to spend time with my family. I've had a real opportunity this weekend, especially having my daughter as an entrant for the teen Tunarama as well, to really see a different side of her. And she's come out of her shell. It's been brilliant. And spending the time with all the entrants this weekend, actually, we've all seen a different side of each other, had a bit more fun and just chill out a bit.
And I guess also we can hear in the background before the music from the Indian community, but it just brings so many different communities together here, not only in Port Lincoln, but right across the Eyre Peninsula. There's people that travel interstate, there's people that travel internationally as well to come to Port Lincoln for this. So it's a real well-known festival.
Yeah, it is. It was wonderful to see the diversity at the Trinitas yesterday, actually. We had people from all over Germany. And I think Brazil was the one that stood out in my head because I was thinking of nuts straight away. So, it was really good to see them all and to see the different groups get out. It's fantastic. And the lantern ceremony the other night was just amazing. I actually managed to jump in and my daughter managed to adopt one and bring it home to the kitchen, which scares the bejeebies out of me every morning, but that's okay.
And just finally, Belinda, how's your tuna tossing skills?
Sadly, I still never tossed a tuna, but there is a tryout right now down there, so I really probably should go down there and give it a whirl.
And come out next year for the 60th anniversary and give it a crack.
Yeah, why not?
So, Bella, that was Belinda Curry. She's the 2020 Tunarama Ambassador, and she's in for a busy year because this time next year, Tunarama will be celebrating its 60th anniversary, which is very exciting.
Brooke, how are your tuna tossing skills?
Well, I took part in the tuna toss a few years ago and I threw the second longest throw in the heats, and then, like the South Australian football teams, I got to the finals and choked, so I didn't do too well. But I've heard that there's actually, with the cruise ship in at the moment, there's actually a tuna toss come and try down at the beach, so I think I might have to go down there and maybe for the 60th anniversary give it a crack next year. And I think, Belle, I'm going to throw out the challenge to you as well, live on air, to come over and toss a tuna, and we'll see who can do it the best.
Oh, I already know who's going to win this one. I mean, how heavy are they? They're pretty solid.
Yeah, they are. They're a solid tuna, and it's the rubber tuna, so it's the pretend tuna, so they're not tossing the real ones anymore because they were just going to waste too much. But they'd be probably, at least 10 kilos, I think. I don't have the exact weight on me, but it's, they're definitely a heavy tuna to toss, and the young kids also get involved with the teenagers toss a rubber salmon, and the young kids toss a rubber prawn, so there's a category of seafood for everyone.
My kind of comp, I think I'd go well in the prawn tossing, I reckon.
Well, we'll see you this time next year.
Excellent. All right, thanks, Brooke.
Thanks, Bella.
That's Brooke Neindorf over in Port Lincoln. I think they also do a watermelon eating competition from memory as well. Last time I was at Tunarama, it was a few years ago, but it's a great weekend up at Port Lincoln. 0467 922 891 if you'd like to send me a text. You can also join the conversation by calling 1300 222 891. Perhaps you took part in the tuna toss. I'd love to hear from you today. 1300 222 891. It's 13 minutes to one.
When it comes to women's cricket,
summer never sounded so good.
Shot, it doesn't connect, and she's out.
Confusion, run out.
And there's more cricketing action on the way.
Flicks it away, backward of square, it'll find the rope.
ABC Grandstand, summer of cricket.
Gets a thickish edge and it races away for four.
It's another big float.
Don't forget, the men are back in March to play New Zealand.
And Marnus Labuschagne punches the sky.
Catch all the action on your radio, online and on the ABC Listen app.
This is ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
Well, it's coming up to 12 minutes to one. My name's Isabella Pittaway, and on the text line, Linda from Yudunda says, great news that the freight is being subsidised for fodder to KI. We're facing our third year of drought and have never been offered freight subsidies like other states. When is the South Australian government going to wake up and play fair? Thanks for your text, Linda. And John at Wallaroo saying, why won't the minister, the primary industries minister, say how much the commercial sector can take, because they will shift to the southeast and continue on unabated? 0467 922 891 if you'd like to join the conversation. 1243, 1201 and 4069, I mean, they're hardly the catchiest names for a popular, delicious tropical fruit. But maybe under another name in the future, they'll be a staple on many people's shopping lists. That is, of course, if you like mangoes. Those numbers are new varieties of mango being bred on the Atherton Tablelands in far north Queensland. Tom Major spoke to grower Brad Bowen about how the crop performed and just what ideas he has about finding a better name for the juicy summer fruit.
Yeah, fantastic. We're just over the moon with the quality of the fruit and the flavour, the shelf life. They're all very positive. So, yeah, it looks very good.
So what's the genesis of these new breeds? Tell me a little bit about their background.
Yeah, they've been bred through DPI and DAF up at Walkerman, basically, and KP base. So a lot of the new varieties have that beautiful Kensington Pride flavour. So you've got the flavour of the KP, but you have the beautiful R2E2 flesh. The texture's fantastic, and they just last.
How did the consumers react to them? You had them in stores for the first time ever. Now that they're, I think you said, about 3 years old and they've got their first crop off them, what was the reaction from the shop floor?
Yeah, well, we're still getting feedback now. Yeah, from what we've heard so far, so good. Everyone seems pretty happy about it.
You tried them yourself. What did you think?
I've eaten a lot, yeah. we love them. I really enjoy eating them. I think they eat great. I love the flavour and I love the texture. They tend to be the one I go to, and I know any of our friends and family that come and we give them mangoes, we give them one of the new varieties, and they always say that that was their favourite. So, yeah, I'm really happy. It's a good positive. The R2E2 has a few more opportunities with export into your Asian countries. The texture, it's a much smoother texture with the eating, and they're a big mango, so you really get a nice meal out of that mango. They're quite good like that. The KPs and the Kensington Prides, the flavour in them is just amazing. How do you beat that flavour? It's one of the nicest mangoes around.
That's an interesting looking tree too. It's quite a compact sort of looking thing. I know they're only small, but they seem to have quite a compact kind of shape to them. And these quite thin sort of strappy green leaves, how are they to grow compared to, say, the R2E2s?
Yeah, the vigour on them is a lot less. They're not a really fast-growing tree with this variety here, with a 1243. So out of the three varieties, the 1243's probably got the least amount of vigour we're finding, where the other two varieties, the 1201, 4069, they have a lot more vigour. We can plant them closer, we can have more trees per hectare, and hopefully get a higher yield out of that.
What are you expecting to ultimately yield from these trees?
Well, if we could get it up around that 40 tonne to the hectare, I think we'll all be smiling at that. So that would be our goal.
Will you be planting more of them?
Yeah, we're going to plant. We've got some more going in the next couple of weeks. As they come out of the trial phase and we start going more into the commercial phase of it, it will definitely keep planting them. I think they're going to be very popular.
And just finally, you've got to come up with a more catchy name than their present ones. What are you thinking about in terms of a more commercially successful name for these fruit?
Yeah, that's definitely on the cards. So part of the trial program through the Australian Mango Association is commercially trialling the fruit, getting everything right. And then when we're happy that it can be commercially put out there, yeah, they're just going to go for the best possible name they can. So hopefully it'll be very appealing. Maybe we have to have a competition.
Burdekin specials.
Well, I think we can do better. Yeah.
I've got some suggestions, but I don't think that Brad Bowen, the mango grower from Brandon, south of Townsville, would like them. Brad was speaking there to Tom Major. Up next, Backroads heads to Menindee.
This is ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
And it's 7:01. Well, Menindee on the banks of the Darling River grabbed national headlines as the site of mass fish kills last summer. But as ABC's Lisa Miller discovered while filming an episode of Backroads, there's a lot of life and joy in the town. Lisa Miller told Andrew Schmidt about her time in Menindee and an unexpected surprise upon her arrival.
They'd been in the middle of a drought for a long time. They hadn't seen rain for months and months and months and months. And what's the first thing that happens the afternoon that we arrive? It rains I mean, there are some things that you cannot predict. I mean, gosh, they didn't get much that afternoon, but we immediately thought we're going to have to work this into the story somehow because, you know, it's too insane that we've turned up here and suddenly water's falling from the sky.
It's all the back road episodes, one thing that shines through, regardless of what location it is, that the people you speak to have such a passion for where they live. And is that what you found in Menindee?
Absolutely. And, I mean, I think that's what you find right across regional Australia. I'm from the country. I'm from a small town called Kilkeven, which has a population of about 700 in Queensland, which is 200 more than Menindee these days at the last count. So this is the kind of town that I know. You know, I know the kinds of people who live in towns like this, and they get pretty defensive when outsiders start bagging them or look down their noses at their little town. And, you know, even when I asked people in Menindee, why do you stay? They looked at me like, why are you asking that question? Why wouldn't we stay? You know, what are you saying about our town? The other thing that was struck us, Andrew, was what a great sense of humour people have. Oh, my Lord, like they laugh and laugh. And I have not laughed so hard. We went to the pub to do some filming one night with a bunch of old guys that call themselves the Table of Knowledge, because they're the judge, jury and executioner on everything to do with the town. And they are so funny. And, you know, even going to the local op shop and chatting to the women who had, you know, sitting there with the roses that had been grown by people in the Anzac Garden. I mean, there was just so many beautiful things about the town. I've got to tell you, though, a bit of a secret, that I ended up playing touch footy with some of the locals, and I discovered I can't play touch football. I may or may not have had to go to a physiotherapist in Jura on the way home.
Lisa, the other thing, I suppose, that once you do start to travel around regional areas, that people who live in these areas don't ask for a lot and don't expect a lot, but the one thing that's, this is prior to the bushfire season, that has been a rallying call for people in a lot of regional communities is water, or sorting out the water management. And I've got no doubt that your time in Menindee, sorting out water management would have been one of the key topics that people spoke to you about.
Yeah, absolutely, because, you know, whether it's the Indigenous communities who are talking about why the Mighty Darling has been so important to them over the generations, whether it's the grape growers, the transport trucking company, you know, the guy who moved there a few years ago to do boat tours down the river. I mean, we spoke to a lot of different people, but it's not the focus of the piece, because I think a lot has been written about water and about the fish kills. And as a journalist, you know, we drop into places when big stories happen, and you talk about the fire season and what's gone on with so many towns. You know what it's like. You land there as a journalist, you know, you tell the stories, and then you disappear. And I think what we don't do enough of is actually going back to these places, you know, whether it's 12 months later or years later, but also telling the stories of the people behind the headlines. And, okay, so the fish kill and the dispute and the debate over water is huge. It's a big deal, and it does get talked about a lot, and of course we do feature it in the story. But what we wanted to do was to say to people, hey, if you think you know Menindee because you saw headlines or read about the fish kill, well, you don't know Menindee. We're going to tell you a bit about Menindee, and that is why we then talk to the kinds of people we do, and we tell the story of this fabulous school in Menindee that is doing the most incredible things and producing the brightest kids with a principal who is driven to give them the best start that they can have, a principal who grew up there and went to school herself in Menindee. And it's just, I mean, it's hard not to come away from Backroad Stories feeling pretty good about the world, because these are the people that, even when they're knocked down over and over again, get up and say, hey, you know what? We can do this. We can cope.
That was Lisa Miller speaking to Andrew Schmidt about her visit to the far west of New South Wales, and Backroads Menindee screens tonight at 8 p.m. on the ABC, and you can also catch up on ABC iView. And if you'd like more rural news, you can go online to abc.net.au/rural, and on there you can see really the diverse nature of this country, with a story on the towns running out of water right next to a story about huge falls in central and western Queensland. And that story about towns running out of water is getting quite a few comments on the ABC Rural Facebook page as well. May here saying, yep, we have to bring desalinated water to the bush. And Noel is saying it's a complicated situation. However, the bottom line is people's lives are compromised due to the lack of water, a basic human right. So a solution must be found ASAP. That is all the time we have left for this Monday. I'll be back with you tomorrow. It's coming up to news time, 1 o'clock.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.